Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When I was pregnant with my first child, I remember trying to imagine what life would be like as a mom. How would I feel? Would I be good at it? Would I like it? What if I hated it? And of course, I had no idea just what a wild ride I was in for. I think this catches many moms by surprise.
Motherhood has changed me in so many ways that I did not see coming at all.
The most overwhelming feeling I had was that I could do anything.
It grew my heart about 10 sizes.
I never thought that I could love another human being as much as I love my daughter.
So much love, and also so many challenges, big and small.
Raising humans is a tough gig.
As a single mother, I have not entirely prepared for what my life would look like once my sons started their young adult lives.
I used to be a night owl, now I'm a morning person.
I can no longer watch any Disney movies without crying.
I cannot hear live music without crying. Feeling too full of emotions, I don't know what it is, but since I've become a mom, live music just does me in. I get very weepy.
I used to be anxious about myself and my future, but now I'm anxious about my children. And anxious that my anxiety has made them anxious too.
I'm constantly concerned with what will my daughter's future look like.
I don't remember who I was before her. I was very different prior to having my daughter. I just remember floating through life with no purpose.
It's brought out the best in me and the worst in me. It's been lonely and it's been overstimulating.
Clinical psychologist and researcher Orly Athan wanted to capture the nuances of motherhood. What were the big challenges, the personal growth, the newly discovered strengths? She searched for materials across disciplines, anthropology, nursing, cultural studies, social work, and she found there wasn't much out there. So she started doing her own research, long interviews with mothers with open-ended questions.
What I heard was that it was both the most crippling and empowering experience. And they felt quite stretched by the experience and deepened by the experience. And also they started to sound a lot like anyone who has gone through a life transition, you know, in which there were changes in all the dimensions of their life, all of the domains, in their bodies, in their body image, in their peer group, in their feelings and moods that were fluctuating, in their ability to participate in the economy or politics. These larger questions, existential questions about who am I in this world, and is there anything sacred that I hold dear?
Much to Orly's surprise, many of the mothers she interviewed had never really talked about this in such depth or been asked about it. They felt that motherhood had shaped them in so many ways they were yet to understand.
They were both disoriented, these mothers. They were confused. They were saying, why didn't anybody ever tell me that this is what I was going to experience? But most of all, they were trying to understand what was happening to them.
On today's episode, we'll explore motherhood and the changes it brings. Then we'll pivot to another important time in women's lives that can feel pretty overwhelming. Another one of these, why didn't anybody tell me about this, experiences menopause.
It's just amazing the cultural silence about menopause.
Let's stick with motherhood for now. So Orly Athan was trying to capture this complex change that the mothers she was interviewing were describing, changes across all aspects of their lives. And then one day she came across a word that seemed to hit the nail on the head, matrescence.
and you pronounce it like adolescence. And it was then when the penny dropped.
It was a huge aha moment. The term made so much sense.
Because the minute I say matrescence like adolescence, a light bulb should go off. You should remember everyone has had an adolescence. And you should remember what that felt like. And if you were an adolescent 100 or more years ago, you would have thought that you were going crazy on the way to adulthood. They did not even have the term adolescence to talk about the storm and the kind of ironing out process that happens. So the way I describe it is think of your adolescence when there are changes in your body, your identity, your peer group, your political and economic status. So I say, show me a mother and I'll show you someone who has completely transformed their worldview.
The term matrescence was coined by medical anthropologist Dana Raphael in the 1970s. She also popularized the term doula, by the way. But Dana used matrescence more to study how motherhood changes somebody's social status. Orly broadened it out to look at the entire experience of mothering. Matrescence is not tied to giving birth. It is tied to taking on that role more so than the biological effect of having given birth to a child.
Yes, I would have to agree with that in my experience in interviewing mothers of all kind and parents of you know, all sexualities and genders, those who carried a child through pregnancy or through fostered a child or through adoption, however their child came into the world, through surrogacy, with their own genetic material or not, their mind went through this transition. That is to say, however, that the biological reality of, you know, carrying a child and giving birth to a child has its own unique experiences that also play just as important an impact as any of those other dimensions. You know, we have things like birth trauma that now is also being, you know, highlighted as something that a woman can be still processing, you know, years and years after. But when I do an assessment of a parent, I really listen for the pain points and the growth points, and you never know where they're going to come from. For one parent, it might be that they got passed over for a promotion at work, and they really felt that they hit the maternal wall, you know, economically. And that's where they felt the pain. Or there was a rupture in their partnership and in their marital life right at the same time. Or they felt a sudden growth in their creativity. I think, by the way, creativity is a wonderful word to talk about this holistic change. Mothers come out more creative. As we know, the mompreneur is a, you know, another example of that.
I was thinking about how we prepare for motherhood, generally speaking. So if you are carrying a child and you are preparing for birth, everything is geared toward birth and giving birth. And then after that, there is nothing. So it's like if we were competing in a sporting event, it's like, let's say there's one hurdle in the beginning and we get prepared to get over that one hurdle and maybe we clear it just fine and maybe we get bruised, but nothing at all prepares us for the race. And that is like so odd if you think about it. That is just so wrong.
I completely agree. I mean, how narrow a view, how myopic. So when I inherit mothers in my clinical practice, after they jump the hurdle, not only are they saying, oh my gosh, there's so much more, but why didn't anybody tell me on the way in? I would have made different choices. And so this lack of education is my major platform, I would say, because I think it is doing such a disservice to anyone. We haven't prepared folks to really think about their participation in family life. And so we've done a great disservice, and that's why you hear the most common refrain, why didn't anybody tell me?
Because the changes that you go through are so profound, and then, you know, you don't really realize them until years later.
Mm.
It takes a long time. I was talking with a friend the other day, and she asked me about how my pandemic was, basically. And I said, you know, it's a little bit like parenthood. You get thrown in there and you adjust. And then years later, you're like, oh, wow, that was all a really big change. But I still don't know what to make of it. You know, it's like we can't process these things while we're doing them.
That's right. So I don't think we can ever prepare fully, but we can educate. And then on the other side, we have to process it. And it's not going to, you know, like, it's not like debriefing immediately after a crisis. It's going to take time and returning to the subject over and over again. So spaces have to be created for mothers to digest, reflect, and make meaning of their experiences. And even in my class, all of my students go and interview a mother, whether it's their own or someone else. And you'll find, even or grandmothers, and you'll find that even with experiences that are 20 or 30 years behind a woman, this is the first time anyone has asked them about it. I find that very troubling. So it's, we've rendered this deep subject invisible for the mothers themselves, because I think it's so ubiquitous. But it's going to take a curiosity in the culture to really look at a mother differently and to look at parents differently and say, you know, this may be happening behind the scenes, but it doesn't mean that it isn't a remarkable, remarkable life story.
In my experience, mothers are and were also a bit reluctant to talk about those struggles. I eventually found some with whom I could be very open, but there is a lot of pressure. There is a lot of pressure to perform in some way and to just like adjust, and then you're pushing a stroller around and everything is fine. And I found the conversations were often not very deep. They were totally focused on the baby. Like, what does the baby do? Is the baby doing this? Is the baby doing that? But it was never about us.
Yes, agreed. I don't think that safety was built into the experience to be able to disclose that you're having a mixed experience or a hard time or even not enjoying it at all and regretting it all along that continuum. It really starts with just cultural ideals, right? What the ideal mother should be experiencing. And so if you're not loving every minute of it, it's really hard to check in and say that out loud. It takes courage. That's a deep conversation that goes beyond, you know, what are you purchasing for your baby? And in terms of the baby-centric ideology, I mean, that was the thing that really got me, that the empathic thrust is always on the child. I understand why, because it's our most vulnerable of the two, right? It lacks the power. But the feminist psychology will say, but women are also experiencing motherhood in a system of their own oppression. So they are, you know, gifted with the role to raise children, which is considered one of the most central in the survival of the human species, but it's done during their own disempowerment. So they feel very trapped and stuck. A powerful picture I have in one of my papers is of a Victorian portraiture in which the mother is cloaked in a rug and the child is on her lap so that the baby can be central to the frame, but she's completely cloaked and rendered invisible.
When mothers hear this word, matrescence, how does it help them shape their experience and make sense of it?
Well, that question gives me chills, because I have literally the voices and faces of the mothers before me whose shoulders just go down and a sense of relief washes over them. And I think it's our job to really unpack, why would they feel so relieved by that? I think one of the first reasons is that it takes the pressure off of getting this perfect and right under a certain time constraint. Because the time that it's going to take her to developmentally transition to the other side, if there is one, is so unique to the individual person. And so that takes the pressure off there of performing and being already in that identity before a person is actually subjectively ready. I think the second thing that it does is that it normalizes many of the struggles. to understand that we give compassion and patience to an adolescence when they're in this upheaval. We do not expect an adolescent to do this overnight or to do it even elegantly or well. And I think that takes that pressure off. And then lastly, it gives them a positive growth mindset, which has always not been made available to them, to say that actually you can make of this experience something wonderful.
When we enter adolescence, we tend to not have a fully formed identity in a way that we think about a lot, you know, and then we become adolescents and it's forming this identity. When we become mothers, we tend to already have an identity, and then we are forming this new identity, whether we are realizing it or not. And often there is this desire to go back to be more like the person we were before. You know, there's all this pressure, just speaking about bodies alone, to get back your body the way it was before and to be just as effective and to do all the things. But I do think there's this wish to gain back your old identity.
Agreed. I mean, these are the cultural memes. When are you going back to work? When are you going to fit back on those old jeans in your size? There's a lot of going back. And so matrescence also goes against the grain on that one because it is about forward. But it is absolutely natural that once you've, you know, gained a hard-won identity, right? All gone through adolescence, found your social circle, your professional, you know, identity, for it to go undergo a 52-card pickup again, no thank you. But the joke's on us, because identity formation doesn't stop at adolescence. It's a lifelong process. And so we also got sold this idea that it's one and done, when really we are born again, 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 and again, and we have to practice this experience. Of course, some of these turning points are more rough than others. So I would say, you know, do away with the one and done thinking. But along with that, I want to tell mothers, you haven't lost yourself entirely. There's a through line in you, right? It doesn't get severed. And that you have to remember and recall along the way, not only, you know, where you're going, but where you have been. And that's why it's a narrative process. The hero has turning points, the heroine has turning points and great adventures, but they bring themselves with them along the way. So I hope that's the new mythology of motherhood for the future, is that we remember who we are through the process and we only deepen it.
You know, as I was reading your work, so much of this made sense to me. And, you know, I'm not prone to theatrics, but when I think of my early experience as a mother, I have this image of myself like running toward the bus with my stupid breast pump and my lunch and all this stuff. And then sitting on the bus and then just having like tears roll down my face and not even knowing like, why am I crying? And every time I think about that now, it's like 11 years later, I still have tears coming to my eyes. And I can't explain like why, what the sadness is. I think I'm just sad for myself, you know, like having not understood that it's okay to feel like that overwhelmed, if that makes any sense.
It makes so much sense. And you're not alone. You weren't alone at the time, but you were made to feel alone. And I think that there's nothing more sad than feeling isolated in the mess of life without any support, without anyone to hold you. So we often say, who's holding the child? And I say, who's holding the mother holding the child? And you're being thrown into an experience that has as well, like a really steep learning curve, right? Think about even the breast pump.
I'd rather not.
Every stroller has its own way of opening, and that frustration. And you had to sort of come into singing your own tune on your own, you know, where you were able to carry that stroller and that pump, and you finally mastered it. But you did that all on your own. And, you know, maybe you got a pat on the back for having some grit, but I'd rather leave the grit at the door. I'd rather have help. I'd rather have help and education and compassion and love during this time. And to also, you know, hold my ego that is being really hit this whole time. It's extremely disempowering and confusing. So I would send a lot of love back to that person at that time.
Thank you. What can people do to support mothers, especially those who are just getting into the game, so to speak?
Well, I think being curious and turning them into people and really asking time and time again, how is this for you? So don't rush in and say congratulations or how wonderful. You know, really sit and take a beat and check in and say, how are you feeling? How has it been going for you? And ask for concrete suggestions of help. You know, can I come in and wash the dishes for you, especially in the early period so that you can sleep? So it's both social support, practical support, and most of all, curiosity. You know, so many mothers are far more alone than any other generation. There's been a lot of dispersion of family or kin geographically because people move around a lot more in a globalized society. They might be delaying their entry into parenthood, so they might be older parents, and so their extended family might be older than they can to participate. So there's a lot of isolation and gaps in, you know, this holding system for the mom. So I would really try and help fill the gap for a mother.
Aurelie Athan is a reproductive psychologist and a professor at Teachers College at Columbia University in New York City.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about monumental changes in women's lives. So far, we heard about the experience of motherhood. Now, on to another significant phase, one that can feel lonely and bewildering because the topic is still pretty hush-hush, menopause.
It's just amazing the cultural silence about menopause.
That's Jen Gunter, an OBGYN and outspoken voice on women's health issues.
With menopause, if menopause walks in the room, the conversation just stops.
Jen hopes to change that with her book, The Menopause Manifesto. In it, she discusses everything from hormones to hot flashes, diet, lifestyle, and sleep, offering a powerful new way to frame this time of transition. In your book, you say that menopause essentially is puberty, but in reverse. But you also say that we tend to treat it like a precursor to death in some way. So why do we have this weird attitude toward menopause?
Well, I think it's a complicated mix of many factors. So I think that, you know, a largely patriarchal society has primarily prized women for youth and the ability to reproduce. And obviously, menopause is a sign that those two things are not there anymore. And so I think it's, you know, largely been, you know, a marker of irrelevance for women, which is incorrect. But I think that that sort of is really the basic root cause.
What happens during menopause? What is going on inside of your body that kicks off this part of your life?
Well, there's a complex change in the brain-ovary connection. I think that's probably a good way to summarize it. And essentially the eggs, or what we call oocytes, are getting to the point where there are none left that are capable of ovulating. And as this process of ovulation, monthly ovulation with the menstrual cycle, starts to wind down, that's the time that we call the menopause transition. And when the last egg has ovulated, that is menopause. We typically refer to menopause as starting sort of 12 months after the last period, because you don't really know it's the last period until it's the last one. So it's this process of ovulation winding down and stopping, and all of the hormonal repercussions that happen because of that.
Now, I read your chapter on hormones, and it's hard to imagine a more complicated process happening every month in our own bodies while menstruation is still going on. It seemed a bit, to me, almost like an orchestra that plays together and kicks off all these different themes and tones. And then when menopause hits, it sort of devolves into a cacophony for a bit. So what exactly is going on with your hormones during this time?
So that's an excellent description. So absolutely, hormones are exactly like, you know, an orchestral piece. Everything coming in at the right time, you know, you need high levels of certain hormones for brief periods of time, just like, you know, you might want the horn section to be loud for a brief period of time. And all together, you get this beautiful end product. And with the menopause transition, there's a little bit of chaos with that. So levels of some hormones may be higher for a period of time, or they may be lower. And all of that produces changes. So irregular periods can be the result. For some people, there can be a trigger in depression or a feeling of brain fog. Some of these things are temporary. So one example I like to use is that menopause is in many ways like a new operating system, being uploaded onto a computer. And while that's happening, can sometimes be a little bit glitchy. And then once it's up and running, now you have this different program. And so some of the symptoms of the menopause transition are from that glitchy upload. Some of the things are long-lasting. So for example, hot flushes can be quite long-lasting for some people, average duration 7 years. Vaginal dryness can go on for the lifetime. And so some of these things are long-term, some of these things are short-term, but almost all of them can be managed.
I think one of the biggest topics I hear women complain about is sleep, or the lack thereof. So what is going on with your hormones that causes this terrible just pattern of wakefulness or just very restless sleep?
So there's a variety of things that can contribute. And certainly I would say, you know, among the top sort of 3 to 4 concerns about menopause, or, you know, medical concerns, is definitely sleep. So for many people, it's hot flushes or hot flashes, depending on the term that you like to use. And you're being awakened by the hot flashes, so the heat wakes you up, or you're not quite waking, but you're getting to a stage of less restful sleep. So you're sort of partially awaking multiple times throughout the night. And that can have a huge impact on, you know, how deep you sleep, how long you sleep. And then also, it's important to point out that menopause is happening at a time of people's lives where often there may be other stress going on. And in addition, for some people, you know, as we age, we also develop medical conditions. So this could also be the time that something like sleep apnea is developing. So while it's important to recognize that menopause absolutely could be a contributing factor or even the cause of poor sleep, it's also important not to just say, oh, it's all hormones, and to make sure that you're looking at every contributing factor.
And that's a point you make throughout the book, that, you know, menopause plays a big role, but it's not the be-all, end-all that sometimes we think it is.
Right. I like to say that there is a lot of paint on a woman's canvas, and it's not all just hormones. You know, I really kind of rail against that concept, because if you say if everything is all hormones, then then that's really buying into the patriarchal concept that it is all hormones and everything is multifactorial. And certainly menopause has been a neglected one or one treated incorrectly for a long period of time, but it's also not the only one.
How do you view the evolutionary role of menopause? We often hear this myth that, well, women were never supposed to reach menopause because we used to just die before menopause hit. But you say in the book that is not true and you paint a different picture. So what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I heard that same myth in medical school.
Oh, really?
You know, this myth of life expectancy. Oh, yeah, that it was a very common talking point for, you know, for hormones. And this idea that, you know, women all sort of dropped dead sometime in their sort of like mid to late 30s, early 40s. And, you know, what we now believe, or one of the main theories, is that, you know, menopause is part of an important driver of evolution of the species. So grandmothers, it turns out, were very useful historically. You know, they gathered food, they helped provide shelter. It really, you know, takes a village, you know, to raise your children. And if you're thinking about, you know, living thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, where you have to gather food, where you're at the whim of the environment, where you might bleed after you deliver a significant amount and be too weak to gather food for yourself and for your other children. And so grandmothers provided additional support. And so there's a lot of evidence to back that up. It's called the grandmother hypothesis. There's also, you know, evidence of that in killer whale communities. Toothed whales are the only other mammals to have menopause. And when a grandmother killer whale dies earlier than expected, her grandcalves are more likely to die earlier.
And it seems like once you start to look at menopause in a different light, it's also a beautifully orchestrated way of protecting you from having a child when your body may be not ready to have another child, or when you may be not ready to raise another child.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating if you compare us to chimpanzees, our closest mammal relative. They stop ovulating around the same time we do. It's just they die and we keep living. And, you know, it's because living past your reproductive potential has benefit for perpetuating the species. And so for us, you know, if you were reproducing in our 60s or 70s, you know, maternal mortality would be very high. And the worst thing for your young children is for a mother to die, right? So, you know, this is a protective mechanism. Everything is really about, you know, survival of the species.
That's OBGYN Jen Gunter. Her book is The Menopause Manifesto. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our show wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, we'll continue the conversation with Jen and discuss a topic that can get pretty confusing: hormone replacement. What are the benefits? What are the risks?
I have patients in the office who are suffering, and I'll say, oh, well, you know, we have this therapy, this. Oh, I don't want hormones. They're too risky.
That's next on The Pulse.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about menopause with Jen Gunter. She's an OBGYN and the author of The Menopause Manifesto. During our conversation, Jen brought up the Women's Health Initiative, which was a landmark study that started in the 90s and looked into the benefits of hormone therapy. But then instead, it seemed to find that it led to higher rates of cancer and heart disease. Those findings later turned out to be overstated or incorrect, but when it first came out, it created an immediate panic.
It was awful. That's really the best way to describe it. I mean, the headlines were just unbelievable and people were panicked. And you have to remember, OBGYNs are among the most sued physicians and people stopped hormones. We stopped them, you know, professional societies scrambled to sort of figure out the data and, you know, undoing a terrifying headline is really hard.
And this study still continues to shape attitudes and fears around hormone therapy.
Even today, I have patients in the office who are suffering, and I'll say, oh, well, you know, we have this therapy, this. Oh, I don't want hormones. They're too risky. And, you know, once someone has heard, you know, an incorrect piece of information repeated over and over and over again, if you think it takes 3, 4, 5 points of contact to undo one incorrect piece of information, we're really rolling a big rock up a hill.
How do you talk to your patients about hormones, yes or no? What's the conversation?
Well, it depends on the patient. And so, you know, if someone's presenting with symptoms that are attributable to menopause, then, you know, we run through the list of treatments. And if hormones are in that list, which typically they are, we go over the risks and the benefits, but we also discuss all the alternatives. And so, for example, if someone is having hot flushes, there are other treatments besides hormones. There is cognitive behavioral therapy. There is the medication gabapentin. There are hormones. There is the standard hormone replacement therapy, or menopausal hormone therapy, as we now call it. So the standard menopausal hormone therapy with estrogen. But sometimes we can just use doses of progesterone in higher, typically higher than we use for a menopausal hormone therapy. And so there really are a wide range of options. There are also some over-the-counter treatments, which are generally fairly ineffective, but some people want to try those because what one person finds as benefit might be different for someone else. Some people might find a 20% improvement in symptoms is sufficient, and for someone else, that's just not going to cut it.
Is there, in your opinion, a benefit to estrogen that goes beyond controlling the symptoms of menopause? Does it have some kind of protective qualities?
Well, I think that we're still trying to understand the really long-term implications of, you know, being on menopausal hormone therapy. And again, it really depends on what it's doing for you. So a woman who has no symptoms or has mild hot flushes, who isn't bothered by anything, you know, it's possible that hormones for her could have a net negative. You know, there is a small increased risk of breast cancer associated with hormones, and that the absolute long-term risks on dementia are still not completely clarified. So certainly for women starting over the age of 60, hormones would not be recommended. That does seem to be associated with an increased risk in cardiac disease and in dementia. But it does appear to be a window under the age of 60 or within 10 years from the final menstrual period where hormones may, for many women, have a net benefit. But again, it all depends on what are your symptoms, what else is going on with your lifestyle or with your life or your medical conditions. And I always get back to the fact that the three healthiest things a woman can do for her menopause transition and beyond are quitting smoking, getting the recommended exercise, and eating a healthy, balanced diet.
Now, I'm personally just getting absolutely bombarded with ads for different products that will solve all of my problems. But there is this exploding market of different gummies and products that will take care of all of your potentially menopause-related issues. How do we evaluate those? What are some questions we should ask?
Well, if something sounds too good to be true, it is.
Very sad, yes.
That is the truth. And many of these companies, like, you know, we humans love heuristics. We all want something boiled down to a simple fix. We're all like that. And, you know, the companies that make these products are well aware of that. They're playing on emotions. And if there was a simple supplement that took care of all of the menopausal symptoms, we'd be prescribing it. We'd be recommending it. And you know what? Big Pharma would probably have figured that out and they'd be monetizing it, right? So, you know, many, many, many of these herbal and botanical and other supplements have been tested, and they've either been dismal or the quality of the studies is so poor, it's not possible to draw a conclusion. And it's also important to remember that many of these sort of special supplements, I'll call them menaceuticals. I'm not talking about, for example, taking vitamin D if you need it, or taking iron if you have iron deficiency, but these sort of, you know, combination products or things that claim to support your ovaries or support your menopause. It's just all marketing. And there is a rapidly increasing percentage of people developing liver failure from supplements. You know, many of these supplements don't contain what they claim. For example, this is a big problem with black cohosh, a supplement that's frequently an herbal supplement, frequently promoted for hot flushes. First of all, the data doesn't really show that it works, so there's that. But a significant percentage of black cohosh supplements don't contain black cohosh.
And you also say in the book to stay away from sort of over-the-counter hormone products, right? The stuff I could order on Amazon and such.
Oh, absolutely. You have no idea what's in those, first of all, because with supplements, you know, there's essentially no regulation. If you're getting estrogen and you don't know it, that could be putting you at risk for cancer of the lining of the uterus, or depending on the dose, breast cancer or other complications, blood clots, you know, maybe they contain birth control pills. I mean, who knows, right? So I think that a hormone should be a pharmaceutical, because then you know what you're prescribing. You know how it's absorbed in the body. You can predict the results.
I want to talk about some of the lifestyle measures that you mention in the book, and nutrition is a big one. And for lots of women, as we get older, maintaining a healthy weight can become just a horrible struggle, yeah. And to say the least.
I feel you.
Yeah. I mean, it can be all consuming. So what should women pay attention to?
Well, I think, you know, I like to tell people to focus on, health and what's the best for your health. Certainly, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, which I think is sort of a uniquely horrible time for body image, although I suspect every era is uniquely horrible in a different way.
Yes. I don't think it has gotten much better.
Yeah, I think it's just a different type. Is it just different decades or different types of awful? Maybe that's the best way to put it. So, you know, focusing on the building blocks of a healthy diet. So making sure that you have enough fiber. Fiber does so many things for the body. It, you know, reduces your risk of colon cancer. It keeps you regular. Everybody feels better when they're regular. Reduces your risk of hemorrhoids. Nobody likes hemorrhoids, you know, so these are, you know, this is a very important, you know, building block. Fiber also makes you feel more full with your meals. So for someone who maybe has concerns about weight gain, making sure that you're having enough fiber in your diet is a really good strategy. And you need about 25 grams a day. And the nice thing about focusing on fiber is it's adding something in. It's not taking something away. Right. So it's, you know, it's a positive to focus on as opposed to a negative, because we already receive enough negative messaging.
Food can get a little bit confusing because we hear about hormones in foods that are either naturally phytohormones or then hormones in foods that were added, like in milk or meat. So that can get really confusing really fast.
Yes, it can. And that's why I devoted several chapters to that. You know, so phytoestrogens are not hormones. There are substances that can act like hormones, and they can act like a weak estrogen on some tissues. There's been a lot of research looking at phytoestrogens, and they don't really seem to help hot flushes at all. They don't seem to have an impact. If they do, it's very minor. But they're also not negative, right? And there are some diets that are incredibly high in phytoestrogens, for example, a traditional Japanese diet. And there's also some diets that are incredibly low in phytoestrogens, like the Mediterranean diet. But people can live in both those areas of the world and have incredible longevity and be incredibly healthy. And, you know, that's because their diet also is, you know, high in vegetables and low in saturated fat and high in fatty fish, high in these things and high in fiber. So high in these things that are beneficial. So if you like phytoestrogens and you like foods that have them, that's great. And if you don't, that's okay too. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of the summary of sort of phytoestrogens. Whereas hormones in food, there doesn't really seem to be the impact that we think. You know, the thing that I remind people is that hormones are actually not absorbed well from your intestine. That's because that's not how we were sort of evolved to get them. We didn't evolve to get hormones from our diet. We evolved to get them from ovaries and our adrenal glands. So it's an internal job. So to absorb, you know, hormones orally requires really sort of massive doses. And that's just not simply what we're exposed to, you know, in our foods. So there may be, you know, other, you know, downstream effects and other things, but for women in menopause or in their menopause transition, I would just say, you know, focus on a healthy, balanced diet and what you like, and try to focus on vegetables, lots of vegetables, you know, cutting back on saturated fats. And certainly if you're not eating fatty fish a couple of times a week, like salmon or tuna or other types of fatty fish, then an omega-3 supplement, you know, might be something that can also be helpful for your heart.
Another huge help is exercise. We lose muscle mass and strength as we age. And Jen says exercise is key, and even a little bit is good.
Yeah, you know, I think many of us have this binary thinking about the things we do for our health. We either have to do it exactly in the right amount or it's useless, right? It's this good or bad binary. And that's not helpful. You know, exercise really is money in the bank. It builds bones. It's good for your heart. It's good for your muscles. You know, building more muscle is good for your metabolism. It helps prevent falls. You know, there are so many ways it's, you know, it can be helpful for people, you know, who have mood issues. And so, you know, any little bit that you do is better than none.
How do you hope women might reframe their thinking on menopause as a time in our lives, getting away from this narrative that it's just one step away from death, basically?
Right. Well, I would say that think back to when you went through puberty. There may have been a couple of years where you did not quite feel yourself. Your brain was changing, your body was changing, but nobody goes back and says, wow, you know, puberty transformed me into this. I would say mostly nobody. There's always probably somebody. We don't go back and look at being a child, the time before puberty, as being the gold standard. You know, these are phases in life that are part of life. And the menopause is just another phase. And it's not bad or good. There's nothing binary about it. It's just another phase. It's just another step in the journey. And a patriarchal society has dominated the script of menopause until recently. And we need to reject that script. We need to rip it up. I mean, it's a sign of strength. It's a sign of perseverance. It's a sign of still being vital in contributing. It's a sign of still being relevant. And so, you know, your worth to society has nothing to do with ovaries, has nothing to do with estrogen. And I guess that's how I'm hoping to reframe it. And also giving women the tools to manage the symptoms so they can continue to be as vital and as amazing as I know they are.
That's Jen Gunter. She is an OBGYN. Her book is called The Menopause Manifesto. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had additional engineering from Adam Staniszewski. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.